Hello, I'm Emily Grace, and welcome to the Stages podcast of Bernstein Private Wealth Management. Life throws lots of challenges at us. We're here to analyze them. Having helped dynamic families prioritize what makes money meaningful to them and then invest for that purpose for close to 20 years now, I've seen people through countless markets and life events. And while every market is different, as we're witnessing with the current pandemic, what remains constant is the need for guidance and advice through all the uncertainty. Helping people navigate the markets and introducing them to some of the smartest investment minds and experts in other fields, I'm looking at you, Liz, whatever the stage in their life, is a real honor. If you or someone you know would like advice or an introduction to my guest, you can reach me at emily.grace@bernstein.com. Today, I've invited Dr. Elizabeth Albertini, a psychiatrist at the Motherhood Center, to join me on Stages to talk about the trade-offs that families are facing today and how they are impacting relationships. Liz focuses her practice on the comprehensive care of women and their families. During this time of metamorphosis, she has been working with parents, helping them think through these trade-offs. So I want to thank you, Liz, for taking the time out of your schedule to speak with us. And I'm going to...
Thank you so much.
Of course, I'm going to set the stage a little bit here because Liz and I are both currently working remotely with two young children at home. So if at any point during this recording, it sounds like there is, you know, massive construction or maybe a herd of elephants, it's probably just our children expelling their extra energy midday. So please forgive us. On another note, we're recording this discussion with a remote audience watching us live through a Zoom webinar. And so for those of you who are watching live, please use the Q&A button on your screen to ask questions, and we'll do our best to incorporate them. So Liz, thank you so much for connecting with us today.
No problem.
Could you tell us a little bit about your work at the Motherhood Center and what the last few months have been like there?
Yeah, hear that. I think it's been a little bit getting feedback from you. Is that better? Okay, great. I'm happy to share that. What we've been seeing is just so much change, and should probably sort of preface it by telling you a little bit about what the Motherhood Center is, and just so you understand sort of who I'm working with. But the Motherhood Center is a center in New York City, and we treat women who are either trying to conceive, currently pregnant, or postpartum, and helping them with mental health issues. So there's, you know, a wide variety of women in terms of their backgrounds, their treatment needs, and we, you know, sort of throughout the pandemic went from being sort of entirely in place in the office, seeing patients coming in for sort of more traditional office appointments, to just over a weekend transitioning to all remote online visits. And it was an incredible thing to watch. I mean, clearly the people who organized, like the tech team, did a great job, and it was something that happened actually pretty seamlessly. And I think much to our patients' satisfaction, in the sense that this was a really challenging time for everybody. And so to be able to maintain some continuity with their mental health providers was really an important thing. That being said, I mean, over a few months, you know, there've been so many changes in terms of how people are living their lives and sort of what the new norm has become. And so I do think that we've seen a lot of transitions in terms of people going from just being in total shock and sort of disbelief about everything that was happening with them to really working through sort of how to create a more longitudinal plan for what the summer was going to look like, what homeschooling was going to be. So that there was a lot of different steps in terms of just the natural development based on the acuity of the situation. And now I think we've entered into a time where people are starting to imagine what it's going to be like potentially to go back to school in this way and what that means for the next few months and the next year, even in terms of these new developments. So.
And how do you see the people that you're speaking with, how do you see them sort of facing these challenges and these trade-offs? What sort of questions are they grappling with?
So I think one of the sort of most notable things, and I sort of touched on it, but was this idea that when things were really acute and new, everybody just sort of turned to isolation and sort of being so fearful of everything beyond the world of their home, because that was an area that they couldn't control. And so sort of going to such extremes to be protective of their families and be home and, you know, doing things like washing down the groceries and, you know, really not going to any stores and really, really hunkering down, almost to the point where, you know, you had people who beyond their immediate family members hadn't seen anybody else in their sort of extended family for months at a time. And one of the things that has been coming up more sort of as the weather has gotten warmer, and I think people feel a little bit more comfortable in terms of going outside and maybe seeing people sort of socially in an outdoor setting, that there's been a lot of difficulty in people making those transitions. And, you know, I guess there's been a few things. You know, one, first of all, let me just preface this by saying most of my patients are New Yorkers, although at this point, most of my patients are scattered all over the country. So that's been very interesting as sort of the pandemic has gotten worse in some areas of the country, and so having patients who had been sheltering there already because it was safer than being in New York at the time, and then now having to contend with, you know, sort of more restrictions, but most people are at least still in the Northeast, the majority of them. Anyway, that I think is important only in terms of sort of how scared people are and, you know, what behaviors are like, because in this part of the country anyway, I think that as the restrictions have lifted, people have started to try to figure out how to move beyond their bubble, and having their house or their apartment being this entirely safe venue where they can really control everything, to trying to then transition to an outside world, but it not being the outside world that was before, right? And so what does that mean? And how do we find a balance in terms of leaving our houses, but doing it in a way that feels safe for us? And then all the difficulties that arise from that in terms of balancing out with everybody else's feelings of safety.
It's amazing how we all thought that the hard part was sort of locking down, but what's, you know, and leaving school or leaving work or staying home, but it's really, and this is what I'm hearing from so many people today and feeling myself, it's really about the reentry that's proving to be the real challenge. And are you seeing that sort of create stress in relationships or between people?
I mean, it's creating stress in all different realms. And so if you sort of think about the different components of our lives, you can like categorize that there's stress in all of them, right? There's stress in the work relationships, there's stress in the immediate family relationships and the extended family relationships, in terms of friendships, in terms of ideas about sort of like what's okay in general. So I'm trying to think of some examples here, but just like the idea of camp, I think was a really big one for people this summer. Since a lot of my patients that I work with are parents, right? But even being a parent, there's a huge range between having a newborn at home versus having a 15 or, you know, 20-year-old who's at home. And sort of like, what do we do with these children in the summertime? How do we sort of try to help normalize and socialize them back? And so depending on the age of the kids, it's been really interesting to see how different families have sort of worked with these challenges, right? And clearly, you know, patients that have newborns at home, even if they have older children, a lot of them are being so much more careful about integrating back into camps and things like that, because being so fearful of sort of bringing home any sort of illness or disease and potentially infecting a newborn. But I think that it also applies to basically anybody who has anyone at home who has any sort of immunocompromised situation. So people who are living with elderly parents and sort of grandparents being in the home, and how they're sort of trying to find that balance between providing their kids with some normal socialized activities, but also balancing out the medical risks in that for their immediate family and the people that they're living with. And that can be applied to, you know, so many other different things. But I think that this is one big stressor that's coming up, and sort of like not wanting to put the kids at a disadvantage because, oh, other kids are starting to socialize. Like, my kid really needs it. They're having tantrums. They're acting out. Like, this is going to be really important for their mental health. But we need to balance that out with this idea of then also medical health.
What do you think about this whole idea that, I mean, it's hard. We talked a little bit about the parent with two grown children, you know, grandparent, two grown children, and who do they see and who do they not see? And what do you think is, how can we, like, what advice do you have for people as they're sort of coming back into this world and trying to figure out who they're seeing, and somebody, you know, one of your friends is willing to see everybody and one isn't, and sort of how do we cope with that? Or like, what advice do you have for me?
Well, I think you actually had two important points in there, and so I wanted to address each of them. But the first was just sort of this idea of having, let's call them grandparents, you know, sort of our parents' generation, and them being very vulnerable, right? And that being said, there's still a wide spectrum in terms of people who are sort of above the age of 65 who are more likely to have more serious medical complications from COVID. In terms of what they're willing to do, right? So you sort of can read about, you know, the family or the sort of retirees down in Florida who haven't stopped their golfing game, right? And they're still going out and doing all of these things. So they're like, well, you know, at this point, I've had a great life. I'm 85 years old. Like, why am I going to stop doing the things that give me pleasure? And, you know, it's not versus people who are much more concerned about their health, right? So you have, even from that like grandparent generation, a different sense of what they're comfortable with. But then you sort of ask those people to invite and sort of wanting to be able to see their grandkids and their kids and having them over. And depending on what the kids, the sort of generation of our age might be doing, I think there's a different level of comfort between different family members and having people over, and that bringing up a lot of feelings and sort of a lot of feelings that maybe are very deep rooted in things from people's childhoods and the way their family dynamic worked when, you know, many years ago, the things they haven't really dealt with. So, you know, people having like sibling rivalry, sort of jealousy, things coming out about like, well, why can they come to the house on the weekends and see you, but we're not allowed to, but oh, wait, I have an essential worker as a partner. And so maybe that impacts how my parents feel about having us come over, right? But like, not maybe rationally knowing those things, but emotionally not being able to separate out those feelings from, you know, sort of when they were younger and maybe sort of more basic feelings. it coming out in ways that is disruptive to the sort of overall family unit, and people really trying to figure out how not to take all these things so personally. So that, I think that's one thing that I was hearing in the question you were asking. Yeah.
And then the tricks for how we handle that, maybe.
The tricks for how to handle that, I mean, that part's much harder, right? I think that ultimately it's a matter of understanding that everybody's coming at this from a different place of sort of what they're comfortable with in terms of risk. And we sort of think about it, and I mean, you know better than I in terms of like the financial side of things, but risk aversion, right? And we think about that a lot in terms of then what that means for integrating back into a more social world, right? And somebody who is very risk averse is going to feel much more uncomfortable doing that than somebody who is more tolerant of that risk. So understanding that we all process these things differently, right? And so first of all, you know, I might be very skittish and anxious about, you know, going to the supermarket today. But once I go out once and I realize that it's not so scary out there, I might feel very different next time, right? And so people sort of understanding some of those nuances, not only for themselves, but also for their partners, for their family members, for their friends, and understanding that each person is going to have to do this in a different way. And that overall, as opposed to sort of placing judgment on other people for how they're behaving and sort of what they're doing or not doing, sort of just being open to the idea that we're all struggling with this and it's not easy for everybody. And just, you know, if you've made a decision to send your child to a pod camp, right? Like that's a decision that your family had to make for whatever reason, right? And sort of understanding that those kinds of trade-offs that every family is making right now are going to be hard for them to decide. But just being sort of empathetic towards where they're coming from, and also empathetic towards yourself in terms of where you're coming from.
Which that leads into a question that we've actually received asking about, is there something that we should be doing to help others with this, mm-hmm. right? So if we see, you know, our kids having some issues or our siblings or our parents, is there something that we should be doing, or should we just, you know, give them your name and number and say, call Dr. Albertini?
No, I mean, I think there's lots of things you can be doing. You don't necessarily have to seek professional help. You can just sort of help them understand that you want to listen and you want to understand where they're coming from and you're here to support them, right? If there's a specific issue at hand in terms of, you know, they're feeling very uncomfortable with one particular activity or something, right? Maybe sort of helping them think of new ways to work around, you know, being in that activity. So let's say, you know, they really want to be able to let their kid go on a play date, okay? And they feel very uncomfortable with the idea of a play date, right? Like, hear them out, try to support them, try to understand where they are right now and sort of like what they're grappling with. And rather than giving them, you know, like, oh, everybody goes on play dates, why aren't you going on play dates too, right? Like trying to be understanding of the fact that like, this is hard for them. And there's clearly something about a play date that is really sort of triggering and scary. And so, you know, what is that? And how do we find a way, maybe they can't go on a play date, but maybe they would feel comfortable, you know, having their kid ride a bicycle and another kid ride a bicycle, like around a parking lot, right? And it's not, the kids don't actually interact that way, right? So sort of helping them find strategies for maybe doing things that feel more comfortable and in their way of re-entering, as opposed to your way of re-entering.
I saw a great thing online, which was, you know, okay, everybody, now practice saying this. When your friend says to you, I've decided to send my child back to school full time. Wow, that must have been a really tough decision to make. You know, when your friend says to you, oh, I've decided I'm going to homeschool my child and never let them leave the house again. Wow, that must have been a really tough decision for you to make. And so it's sort of that idea of helping people feel comfortable with, or I guess it's the word judgment, right? Yeah. Trying to release your own judgment in this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's something that a lot of people, you know, are struggling with, partially just because we come at things from our own vantage points, right? And sometimes it's hard to remember that everybody else doesn't have the same set of reasoning that we do, and all the different, you know, factors that sort of like made us who we are today and in our lives, like that might be very different for somebody else. And so sort of placing non-judgmental statements there and really sort of helping support people in whatever choices they've made, right? I think that's basically what I'm hearing in those comments, right? It's just like, it's a challenge to, it's, nobody's gonna be comfortable with anything right now, right? The world is still a very unknown and unpredictable place. And so we're all just trying to make the best choices for our families, for ourselves in this time that has no precedent, and we don't really have a good roadmap. So nobody's choices are going to feel perfect, and nobody is going to feel entirely confident in sort of the choices that they're making, because we can't, because we don't know. We don't know in some ways like exactly what we're doing in the most like basic sense of like, okay, we're listening to all the information, all the experts, and we're trying to do it the way that makes sense, but it doesn't always, it's not always consistent how people interpret that information for themselves.
Do you think that it's any different when you're dealing with, let's say, an institution, right? So we talk about sort of supporting other people in their decisions, but what about, you know, if you believe that, you know, your child should be wearing the mask to school and the school is saying, no, you don't need, the kids don't need to wear masks, or, you know, vice versa. The school says every child must wear a mask and you're thinking, there's no way my child can wear a mask for 8 hours a day. Does that change the way you might, I don't know, to just say accept that this is their opinion, right, becomes suddenly a little different because it seems to have more of an impact maybe on your own life?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really hot topic right now, right? Like, how do you make people wear masks if they don't want to wear masks? Or do we have the right as individuals not to wear a mask if we don't want to? So I think your question's a little loaded. that being said, no, it's really... when we sort of apply to our children, maybe it feels a little bit different, right? And it's probably something more similar to the idea of like vaccines, right? People have the right to choose if their children get vaccinated, but schools and also have the right to not let a child go to school if that child is not vaccinated. So yes, you know, we can sort of make these personal choices, but if we're thinking about sending our child into a place that a lot of other children who are potentially at higher risk that we don't even know about are there, we also need to understand that sometimes our child's discomfort in a way that's not like really going to create like long-term problems for them clearly, but sort of this mild discomfort that is actually, you know, if we sort of weigh that against this societal risk and sort of doing the right thing for other people, right? That it's clearly the schools are going to be thinking about the general good. And if we're buying into, you know, sending our child out right now and the schools are saying that they need to have a mask on, sort of complying with that.
So when we think about discomfort, that actually leads to one of the questions we've just received. Okay. It's about play dates.
Okay.
And the idea that right now it's, you know, intimidating to ask somebody for a play date and then not hear back from the other parents, you know, and it's complicated, you know, it's even more difficult than it was sort of back, you know, a year ago, if you asked for a play date and didn't hear back, but to reach out to people and be understanding, but not come across as insensitive and not take it personally. So do you have any advice around how people can navigate when they're asking for, I guess it would be the same, you know, for a play date or for a coffee date or, you know, any of those things?
I mean, I think that starting, like taking a step back, right? A little bit before even sort of getting to the point of like, I want to see you in person, right? Because for a lot of people, that is something that feels very personal, like that, you know, maybe the only people they see beyond, you know, the people that they live with are immediate family members, right? And then there are other people that are being very social. And so sort of starting by just getting a sense of where the particular family that you're talking to, where they're coming from, right? They might not want to disclose to you that they have some sort of medical problem that makes them really high risk. And to sort of go into that level of detail with you, maybe just, you know, as somebody who's like the parent of the child's friend, right? Like maybe you're not that close and they don't want to disclose that. So sort of starting off by saying like, oh, maybe we can have the kids have like a Zoom play date, right? Sort of doing it in a way that feels easier and more accessible to people. Or starting off by having a conversation about, you know, what are you doing? What are you guys comfortable with right now? You know, I'm feeling like, you know, my daughter really needs to have some more in-person play dates, but, you know, I also understand a lot of people aren't ready for that yet, right? And sort of testing the waters a little bit before maybe jumping to the invitation, because that might be part of what other people are really sort of trying to contend with, is how to answer that question in a way that doesn't feel like they have to disclose too much about how they made their decisions about what they're doing right now.
Oh my gosh, it's like dating. You have to like get to know how the other family is feeling and what they're thinking.
Totally like dating. And like, I mean, the amount of cheating that's going on. I mean, people are, right? You tell somebody like, I don't see any other families. You're my only family. Like, you know, this is the only play date. But then in fact, like maybe you see on Instagram or something else that, you know, they're actually seeing other families. And so I think that there's a lot of that. And so really sort of having open communication with people, and understanding any time that you see somebody outside sort of your immediate people that you live with, there's going to be the potential that you don't know everything about what they're doing. And so the more people you are seeing, the more likely it is that there's gonna be sort of a break in the links, and that, you know, there might be some outside interaction that you're not aware of, and making sure that you're comfortable with that.
It's interesting. So somebody here mentioned about sort of the idea of having pods and sort of choosing a group to, you know, to be together. But how do you, so I'm going to now turn this around a little bit. And you said, you know, the cheating and the, you know, the more people, the more likely it is. How do you handle, I guess, and I'm going to give you part A and part B. How do you handle if you've created your own pod and somebody within that pod starts behaving in a way that doesn't mesh with your, what you envision for the pod? And then how do you change, how do you, like, are there ways that you can handle it without sort of destroying that friendship? I guess would be, I mean, it would be easy to just say you're out of the pod. So let's start with that. Like, how, what's a good way to maybe handle that where you're not destroying the relationship?
Well, I mean, I think sort of starting off with this idea that, like, you, again, you can't control other people's behavior completely, right? And you can have open dialogue and you can try to understand sort of what they're doing, where they're coming from. But you might also be talking to, you know, one member of the family and a different member of the family has slightly different ideas, and you're not understanding that nuance, right? Like, you know, I decided suddenly that I was going to go and meet my friend at a restaurant, and I didn't tell my husband that, right? And he thinks that, you know, we've all been sort of not doing that, right? And so, wait a second, like, now who is he going to have to go tell that he saw that I went to a restaurant, right? There's like all these levels in that chain.
Oh my God, it sounds like researching companies. Like, you can't just rely upon one data point.
But you can't. I think that's the important thing about thinking about expanding your social circle, right? Is again, sort of coming to terms with the fact that we're constantly balancing out sort of a release of this like isolation and total solitary way of living, and balancing that with being more social, but remembering that anytime we increase the social engagement, you're going to end up also increasing the potential risk for exposure, right? Because people don't know that they're always sick when, you know, they are sick. And I mean, that's really one of the most difficult things about this illness. To come back to your question though, right? Like, what do you do if that happens? I think it's very challenging. And a lot of it comes down to how many people are in your pod, you know, like how big a breach is this? Like, if you have a pod that includes 8 families, right, you have to imagine that there's going to be some holes, and people in that pod are going to end up, you know, seeing other people, right? So even just in terms of establishing who those families are that you might be seeing, like thinking about keeping the numbers small, both for sort of risk level, but really also just for communication and dynamics of, you know, how that interplays.
I question an assumption you just made, where you said that if you have 8 people in your pod, that it's more, that there's clearly there's greater risk, maybe that, like, that there's greater risk that they're seeing other people. But couldn't you argue that if you make your pod big enough, everybody will feel like they have enough people so they can not have to go outside? Whereas if your pod is only 2 or 3 families, maybe you're not getting all your needs met within that pod, right? So if there's 8 or 10 people in your pod, you know, 2 of you can have a play date one time. It's not that you're always all together. So do you think there's a chance that maybe expanding the pod could be the answer?
I think a lot of it on the setting that you're in. So yes, if I was on a remote island and there are 8 families who live on that island with me, it might be nicer to just spend time with everybody. But
I think Barbados suggested that, by the way. They're offering like a 12-month work visa.
But if you're in a place where that is not the case, which most of us are, right, it's not just, again, about sort of having your personal needs met. It's about all the other people in each of those families. And the more people you have and the more people they are seeing, the more likely that there's going to be a mistake made in there, right? It's the, like, law of numbers, right? And sort of thinking about, like, you know, I got, you know, a UPS package dropped off and I forgot to put my mask on. And if it's just, you know, me and my immediate family, the number of people then that are potentially at risk because of that interaction with the UPS guy is just my immediate family. But if I'm also seeing 8 other families, right, then I'm sort of spreading the likelihood of then introducing something to all of them. And so the bigger the number of people, you know, the bigger that pod is, the more likely each of those individual groups within the pod are going to have some potential interaction with somebody who might be sick.
So now what about when you don't get to choose your pods? This is sort of part B of the question. When essentially it's, okay, here are the 10 children who will be in class together, right? Or here are the 4 people, 10 people working on a work project in person together. When you don't get to choose the pod, and you don't really, so you can't say it's just going to be 2 families or 3 families or 2 friends or 3 friends, or you can't say, well, I'm sorry, your behavior does not align with the pod's beliefs. Mm-hmm. How does that work? And since you can't control the other people, what do you do for yourself?
Just doing everything to keep yourself feeling as safe and doing things to stay as safe as possible, right? I think this is one of the big issues with the idea of kids going back to school and why it is such a hard choice for communities to make. You know, clearly if you're living in Arizona right now, sending, you know, your kid into a classroom with 12 other kids, you're gonna have a much higher risk of, you know, somebody in one of those families maybe being sick versus being in a place that has much lower numbers right now. So I think that's a lot of what the school districts are sort of trying to determine in terms of like, when do we open school and can we open school right away? And, you know, for us, those of us who are in the Northeast, who maybe it's looking more likely that there is going to be some form of in-person schooling, I mean, mask, hand washing, you know, sort of doing all the things that are in our control. Because we can't control other people and we can only do the best that we can and, you know, encourage the schools to do all of these things that, you know, we hope that they're doing by just following sort of basic health and safety guidelines in terms of sanitation between, you know, the doorknobs every day and, you know, sort of doing all of these things, but we can't make it perfect. And, you know, unfortunately, your feelings about what is safe, maybe you're coming at it from a slightly more, like just a different way than somebody else. And I think there's also a certain element of sort of privilege that we haven't really talked about in this conversation, but, you know, I've worked in a hospital for 15 years of my life. And although right now I'm not going into the hospital, many of my friends and colleagues still are, and they can't help that. That's their job, right? And that's part of their day-to-day existence. And so the idea that, you know, you're then scared to send your kid to school because their kid is in school as well, right? Like that's really hard for those parents. Like, they don't want to be putting their child at risk either, right? Sort of understanding that, like, everybody, again, just sort of going back to what we were talking about earlier, like, everybody's just trying to make the best choices for themselves and their families to keep everybody safe right now. And sort of entering into any conversation you have with other people with that level of respect about some of the choices that they've made or some of the choices that they haven't been able to make because they've been sort of forced into a situation that maybe is not ideal from their standpoint either, but is, you know, the situation that they're in at this time.
And are there any other tricks? I'm always looking for the quick fix. Are there any other tricks to, I mean, because it sounds like, right, one of the most important things is the idea of communication and having these conversations. And I think that's hard during the best of time. You know, people tend to shy away from difficult conversations. And so are there ways to maybe open that conversation or envision that, you know, if we go back to the playdate question, you know, your child is saying, you know, I really, really, really want to have, you know, my daughter is saying, I really want to have a playdate with Liz's daughter, but I don't really know you, Liz. You know, our kids are friends and I don't, let's just say I don't know you, but they know each other. And suddenly I'm calling and I feel like I'm asking you if you're sleeping with anybody else, you know? And so how do you actually, do you have tips for how to broach that conversation? Should you start talking about yourself first, maybe?
I think one of the things to sort of like think about that, first of all, is like most of our children haven't seen that many other kids at this point, and they're probably happy to see just about anybody right now. So, you know, even if they do say like, I want to see so-and-so's kid, right? Like it, you can also probably massage that in a way that if that's a family that, you know, either you know is not having play dates or a family that you don't know as well and really can't sort of imagine having these kind of conversations with, maybe sort of help redirecting your child's question a little bit too, and helping them understand like why we have some limits still on who we're seeing, right? Because I think that's another confusing thing for kids, is it was easier when like we're just not allowed to see anybody, right? But then now the, you know, children are seeing like, well, why can we see so-and-so but not this other person, right? And sort of also helping them understand a little bit of, you know, that we're allowed to see some people, but we have to be very careful. We're not allowed to see many families, right? Things like that, and sort of helping the child understand that. Then in terms of that communication, you know, I think that just sort of starting off on like an honest footing, right? Like, hi, just checking in, you know, really wanted to know how you guys are handling all of this. It's been, you know, hard for us, and, you know, little Susie's feeling really, you know, lonely. I would love to set her up on playdates, but I'm still struggling with how to make that happen. What have you guys been doing? Right? Like, ask them questions, like, you know, start a dialogue as opposed to sort of throwing out the first question being like, do you guys want to, you know, meet us at this playground?
And do you think there's something about the medium in which the question is conveyed? Meaning, does it make a difference if it's sort of text versus phone versus email versus Zoom versus carrier pigeon?
I mean, I think there's so many ways to communicate now. Even just what I was saying earlier about like transitioning from in-person therapy to online therapy and like virtual therapy, right? Our understanding of how to communicate with people has changed so much in all of this, because we can't really see people face to face, right? And so we're finding other ways. So I think that, you know, any form of communication that sort of allows for a dialogue is helpful, right? The thing about like text messaging or like, you know, messaging, like direct messaging over Instagram or something like that, is those tend to be formats that expect shorter answers. Not really sort of more like nuanced and emotional language. So I think that sometimes that can be tricky in terms of really getting into a deeper conversation when you're with somebody over text messaging. So, you know, having a conversation with them, whether it's a phone call, or I think a lot of people really communicate very well in email. I think the thing about email that can be tricky is, you know, not everybody is sitting in front of a computer all day, depending on what they're doing. And if they're just on their phone, you know, knowing that if you send a really lovely email to somebody, they might not respond to it for a week or two. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they don't like you and they don't want to have that conversation with you. It's just like, they're scrolling through their phone, it sort of goes to the bottom, they forget about it, and then all of a sudden this moment of clarity when they're, you know, falling asleep one night and it pops back to their mind and they're like, oh my God, I never responded to that really lovely email, right? And meanwhile, you might be sitting on the other side and be like, this person hates me. Like, why didn't they respond to me? That's so, you know, like, what's wrong with me? And so not sort of reading into those things as much when it's a form of communication that, you know, a lot of people process as like 2 second reads.
Okay. And I also, I mean, it's amazing because we have a question here that gets to the idea when what we're talking about right now is adults dealing with the sort of psychological aspect of it, and you didn't respond, and, you know, oh my gosh, they don't like me, whatever it is, you know, all, and we've talked for a long time about the impact on us as the parents, I suppose, but how do we help kids navigate these times, right? Like, This person writes, I think it might be frightening for my kids with the message, do not come to people, maintain distance, you know, that it now might be traumatizing to suddenly say, and here's a play date. So how do we help our kids with this?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I will say is that I'm not a child psychiatrist. I'm an adult psychiatrist. I work with parents, and clearly I talk about a lot of parenting issues because I'm working with parents, but I tend to work with the parents. So I'm not necessarily going to go at this question from a developmental perspective. And all of that being said, is the same way that we're talking about with adults, that, you know, each adult is going to re-enter different sort of layers of interaction in their own way. Sort of understanding that is going to be true with children too. And the difference between a child who's 4 or 5 and a child who's 10 or 11, it's going to be quite different in terms of sort of what they're able to handle and process about how you're explaining it to them, right? So for a younger child, just sort of sticking with some of the basics and helping them, you know, recognize like, okay, like we're allowed to meet, but we can only meet outside. We're still not supposed to touch, right? We have to keep our hands to ourselves, things like that, that they can understand. And like, yes, that's safe. We're going to keep you safe, right? Just, I think sort of emphasizing that you are still in control of the situation, even if it doesn't feel controlled to them. Ultimately, that's what kids need, is to feel safe and cared for and sort of like know that somebody's looking out for them. And so if you can help sort of convey that to them, even if you yourself are feeling a little bit unsettled about the situation, but keep it simple when they're young. Right? When they're older, you might need to talk to them a little bit more about their emotional reaction and how they're feeling. And, you know, how does it feel to, like, you know, suddenly be allowed to do some things but not others? And, you know, sort of helping them understand, like, this is really hard for me too. Right? Like, I'm struggling with, you know, I really miss being able to go and have dinner with somebody. And, you know, I miss that. And I can understand why you miss going and being able to play soccer at your friend's house, right? And just sort of helping create some parallels so that they get that it's okay to talk about it and that you're supporting them and that, you know, you're going to get through this.
Okay. So in one word, what is the one thing that people should be doing to handle the various trade-offs of today?
Do, 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 do. One word. I'm going to come up with a few concepts. Yes. Having some patience with themselves and with other people. Trying to just be in the moment a little bit, and understanding that, you know, people are all just sort of trying to get through this, in the best way that they can, and, you know, being understanding of that.
Fantastic. Well, it looks like there are no more. Say that again, Liz.
Oh, I said that was definitely not one word.
No. That's okay. We're Brearley girls. Okay. So I don't see any more questions down here. And I really, really do want to thank you, Dr. Elizabeth Albertini, for joining us today. You know, it's clear that the work that you've been doing at the Motherhood Center and at Mount Sinai in the hospital for years beforehand, you know, has led to sort of the ability to address these questions and conversations and trade-offs that people are really facing today. And I think about it, you know, oftentimes my job is to help people think about the trade-offs, you know, the stocks versus the bonds, or if I spend money on this, what will the impact be on that? And so there's a lot of similarity when we think about all the trade-offs that people are really working with. And as you talk about, you know, patience and communication and sort of being generous with each other, and I almost think, you know, kindness, right? Mm-hmm. That these really are things that sort of drive our life in general. And I can see how they're so key to thinking through all of the trade-offs, whether it's, you know, sending our kids to school versus keeping them home, having coffee with people, organizing play dates, right? All of these trade-offs require us to sort of, I almost think, be almost more vulnerable also through the whole process. And it's been great listening to you. You know, clearly the information that you provided is going to help people as they're thinking through these various issues and navigating them. You know, at the end of the day, it's all about the thinking and the planning in every stage in life that's so crucial. So if anybody listening would like to speak with me, my family engagement team, Dr. Albertini, you can reach me at emily.grace@bernstein.com. So thank you for joining us today, and we'll talk to you again soon.